a lot of the people that I work with, they have extensive networks, yet they're putting, you know, they're putting posts on LinkedIn or social, thinking that that's where their next sale is going to come from. And I see so much value and so much immediate lift in people reviewing their contact list, reviewing their network, identifying, you know, 20 names of people who would be a good fit for whatever you're selling and reaching out to them. And it's simple. It's like, hey, I thought of you the other day. I just wanted to let you know what I'm doing. I'd love, you know, to hop on the phone or whatever. And this is not a cold lead. This is someone warm who's in your network. I'm sure in my experience, they'll hop on, they'll get on the phone with you. And then that's who you're selling to. You're not selling to these cold people that are going to visit your landing page and all of a sudden convert. That's the advice. Any coach or consultant who's listening right now, that's what I would do.
I think you are in BC, correct?
I am. I'm in Vancouver.
I've never been to Vancouver. I've been actually thinking about going to Vancouver, and I have so many friends.
It's amazing.
I've heard that once you see the mountains, and it's really great for like cycling and outdoors activities.
It is. Yeah. Yeah. It totally is. It's very easy to be outdoorsy. It's accessible. Everybody does it. It's beautiful.
What's the correct pronunciation of your name?
Yes. Talitha.
Talisa.
Talitha. The C is a TH.
Talitha.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
Wow.
Talitha. Yeah.
Talitha.
It throws everybody off. Yeah.
Oh, that's really cool. It's so my neighbor, his name is Cem. He's mm-hmm. Turkish, mm-hmm. but he writes it as C-E-M. In your mind, you're like G-E-M, but it's actually C-E. Anyways.
Yeah. Language, man. It's cool.
Yeah. So why don't we start with who you are, what you do.
Yeah.
And then I'll chime in sort of how I found you and what I thought.
Sounds great. Yeah. Oh, I'm excited for that part. So I'm Talitha, and I have been in sales, for a long time. Like basically when I started, when I was in high school, that's kind of when I started my foray into sales. Always selling for other people, companies. I did B2B, I've done B2C. I've sold everything from like men's suits to high ticket coaching to investment advice. And then a couple months ago, I decided to start my own business. It's a sales consulting business where I provide fractional chief revenue officer services to service-based entrepreneurs. So business owners who are coaches or consultants, financial planners, really good at what they do, but have never received any formal sales training, are quite intimidated by sales, and really need help with someone who is obsessed about their revenue as they are. And so that's kind of what I'm doing. It's a very, it's customized engagements, but the focus is getting them more comfortable with sales and being really obsessed with revenue, because people don't like to talk about it. They don't love talking about money. They don't prioritize those money conversations. And so that's what I do.
Right. I think, you know, what's a big giveaway of that? Because right in your LinkedIn profile, and this is what caught my attention.
Yeah.
You were like $750 million in closed sales. I was like, okay, this person likes talking about numbers and money.
Yeah.
So I'm so curious, number one, because I kind of have, by the way, a similar sort of approach to my LinkedIn profile as well. But
I saw that.
But I'm really curious as to, and that's actually one of the first things that struck me. I was like, wait a second, this person, I'm actually curious about what this person does and how did they arrive at the 750.
Yeah.
We'll get into all those details.
Sure.
But the first question I actually have for you, and when I actually looked at your LinkedIn profile and I saw, you know, obviously you've had a whole bunch of different roles, where would you actually attribute this number to? Is it one single thing that you've been done, or is it accumulative over the years? Or
yeah, so it's cumulative over the years. When I was an advisor, I wasn't really giving investment advice. That wasn't my main job. My main job was to bring in business. And so one of the largest deals that I closed was $600 million. It took about a year of work to get that closed. But that is where the bulk of that $750 million came from. And then the other $150 would be from other smaller deals that I was doing when I was in B2B sales. And then I would say probably 5 of that is from B2C sales.
This is like the classic 80-20 thing, mm-hmm. where the bulk of the... But you know what? if you don't mind, and of course, yeah. you know, I totally understand if there's like NDAs and stuff. Mm-hmm. If you would be open to discussing that $600 million deal that you helped close, what role were you playing? What did you learn from that?
Yeah.
I think that would be great for the audience because, you know, somebody who's trying to sell themselves, and this is something that you were talking about earlier, is that, you know, for service-based, they're trying to sell their services, some of that stuff, is there is a bit of an apprehension when it comes to, like, for selling yourself. It's so much easier to help sell somebody else. So now, if we start with that lens of how a deal of that size is sold, and then taking the learnings of that and how you're applying those to those individuals, perhaps.
Yeah.
Would be really helpful. So that's the context, what I'm thinking, basically.
Mm-hmm. Love it.
And feel free to add whatever you think is relevant. Of course, I'll ask and poke around.
Totally. I love that. So this was a large oil and gas company based out of Brazil. And the service that I was selling at the time was treasury management services. I worked with an advisor here in Vancouver, and that's what we provided, treasury management services to large oil and gas and mining companies. And when I started with him, I started in a very sort of admin focused role. There was no sales component. And then probably 3 months into the job, he was like, hey, you always want to be a revenue generator. You never want to be a cost center. So you're going to have to start thinking about things that you can do to bring in business. And at the time, and I think the industry is still like this, wealth management has no idea how to do elegant business development. They cold call. And so I had to pick up the phone and dial for dollars. I had a list of companies that, you know, because if they're all publicly traded companies, I know how much typically, I know how much money they have just raised through an IPO. When I see an IPO come across my desk, I pick up the phone, I'd cold call them. And the goal was always just to get, I mean, I think it's the same for anyone who's cold calling. It's just to get another conversation. I would target the CFOs or treasurers of those companies. I would send them an email, a really brief email at first, so that hopefully they would have seen my name come across their desk before I pick up the phone and call them. And then I gave them a call and was like, I'd really love to discuss the treasury management services we can provide. Can we set up some time? And the whole thing from start to finish took a year. And that's primarily because, they need approvals, you know, they need their board to approve anytime they're like transferring funds. Because they're so large, they had some issues with the contract, like the very sort of generic contracts that we were sending out. So there's quite a bit of back and forth, but it all started with a cold call and a lot of follow-up. And that's kind of when I learned, the importance of, I really don't care how charismatic you are. If you cannot follow up and you don't have a system for like reminding yourself when to follow up and following up, even when people are ignoring you and just not taking that personally, then you're not going to succeed in sales. And so that's kind of what that was a big learning experience for me. And I think another big takeaway from that was just the sheer work that goes into create, like making a deal like that from start to finish. It took, I don't know how many hours I spent on that, but a lot. There was a lot of nurture that happened in between that very first call to when the deal closed. A lot of conversations, not necessarily about treasury management, but just sort of finance in general. And so, there was a lot that went into it.
As you were sort of describing this story, so many other tentacles sort of came out, and I want to like basically follow my curiosity. So number one, what company were you with when you were when you got this deal? Was it BMO or Scotiabank or?
Yeah, Nesbitt Burns, BMO.
That was BMO. Oh yeah. Wow! And I see you were there for about 6 years. So I'm actually now curious what led up to the point where you were able to get to a level of maturity and confidence.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe what was going on in your psychologically, because I think that's one thing that you just touched on at the very beginning of the conversation. You're helping people with that piece, thinking about money. Mm-hmm. So what was it for you? What was that journey like for you to get to that point where you could?
Honestly, pure necessity. So I was really nervous. I was totally nervous about cold calling. I was nervous because I had just become an advisor. And previous to that, I was doing personal wealth management. So retirement planning. I was new to treasury management. And you're talking to CFOs and treasurers. These are people that have, you know, high level degrees in finance who they're fairly brusque and curt in their communication style. And a lot of people are soliciting them. So that made me really nervous as well. But yeah, my boss basically telling me dial for dollars or find a new job was that was a necessity where I'm just like, okay, you kind of just have to suck it up. It will suck. You're not going to be great at it at first. but it's just something you have to do. And so I think for me, one of the big things that I like to talk about with my clients, because so much of sales is sometimes forcing yourself to do things that are uncomfortable and being vulnerable and just kind of being scared and nervous and doing it anyway. And so I think it's really important to think about it takes a huge amount of commitment. And so my whole thing is like, well, what are you committed to? For me, it was financial independence. I could lose my job and then not be able to support myself. Or I could pick up the phone and dial for dollars. And so I was really committed to being independent. I would rather listen to a marathon of the Joe Rogan Experience than never be financially independent. So that tells you a lot because I'm not a huge Joe Rogan fan.
You said all my trigger words. Oh my God. That's an inside joke I have with my friends. We have like our own set of it's like housing market crash. That's like one of those.
Yeah.
And then Joe Rogan is another one.
I'm glad I tapped into that.
Oh my God. That was funny. I think there's something worth sort of double clicking into is on the front end, if the salespeople who have like this very oscillating, depending on, you know, the approach and the kind of product and all that's all those different factors in mind, if enough money's not coming in, or let's say deals are not closed, the people on the back end who have like these very simple, straight 9-to-5 kind of jobs, they don't have that steady day-to-day. Yeah. That steady day-to-day comes when people on the sales front are going
doing their job.
Yeah. So I think one thing that you talked about was, you know, I think sales is probably the only, and I'm making an assumption here, is probably the most uncomfortable and causing daily discomfort that you get kind of obviously with time one might get comfortable.
Yeah.
But what did that, from a sentiment, from a psychological perspective, from an emotional perspective, what was that journey like for you? And how did you deal with those first initial rejections, even though your boss was like, you know, find another whatever.
Find another job. I mean, at first it was painful and I took every rejection really personally. and it took a lot to get over. And so I would like leave work and I would go home and I would mull about it. And I'm like, oh, you know, what if I had said something different? Or that guy was such a jerk. I can't believe he spoke to me that way. And it honestly, like it was just sort of it was the season of trial and error. It was a season of pain and trial and error. And at the time, I hadn't received any formal sales training. It was really like school of hard knocks, crash and burn, your livelihood depends on it. And so that was motivating. And it was enough to kind of keep me sort of moving through that pain. And I'm not sure what happened. I don't really know if there was a specific thing that allowed me to develop a thick skin. I think it was just so much the sheer volume of rejection that I was receiving, and the sheer volume of like just ghosting, you know, like reaching out to people, you have a great conversation, you know, like, you know, it was trial and error. I'd love to think that there was something beautiful that happened. I was like, oh yeah, it clicked and now I have thick skin and now it's water off my back. But no, not really. It was just a lot of rejection and just knowing and accepting that that is just part of the role. When someone is like a hard ass at first, and then you kind of win them over, like there is something just so satisfying about that. And so I think there's, you know, there's a competitiveness to it as well. I find a lot of salespeople are quite, you know, competitive. And I do think you need that competitive spirit to pick yourself back up again and keep moving forward.
If you could go back in time to that day when you picked up the phone and made that first phone call, what yeah. talk would you have? We'll get to that just in a second. But before that, I would love to sort of do a one tiny double click into this whole product of like treasury. And it sounds so boring and it sounds like almost like a procurement thing.
Yeah, it was boring.
It's not like exciting, like transformation or whatever, right?
No.
So I would love for you to think about when you're answering that question of what talk would you have with that person mm-hmm. with everything that you know today is, what is it about what you're selling and how that plays into what are the things that you need to do? So for example, yeah. if it's, you know, for example, if it's a person selling consulting services versus a SaaS product, what are the assumptions of the people in procurement?
Yeah.
So I just wanted to give you some context as to.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. I think that's a great question. And I think first and foremost, you, no matter how boring or how exciting what you're selling is, you've got to personally believe in it. You have to, like, you have to know it works. You have to believe in it. You have to love it. Because if you don't, that just kind of is a recipe for a low vibration selling experience, a lack of conviction. Like, there's nothing worse than a low vibration. You know what I mean? Energy. You're just like Eeyore trying to sell you something. No. So, you have got to believe in what you're selling. And if you don't, your prospect will know. They'll feel it in your energy. They'll feel it in the sort of lack of conviction behind the words that you're selling. And so for me, I mean, treasury management is boring, but there was a huge need for it because a lot of companies, and this is, you know, a lot of detail, but a lot of companies who were basically investing their treasuries into bonds got into a lot of trouble during the 2008 financial crash. And they needed an alternative option. And that's what we were providing them. We were providing them a safer alternative option to investing in bonds. And so did I think it was a sexy thing to sell? No. But the deals were big and that was sexy. And there was a need in the market. And I liked that. I liked the feeling of addressing a need and filling a gap.
So how do you find the mental space or how do you build that belief in a mm-hmm. product like, you know, treasury management? Because, you know, you're not personally affected by it. Maybe like you described, you know, maybe what was exciting to you was the deal size. But what are, in your experience, are there any things that you've tried, tested, which have helped in building that belief, whether that comes to this specific situation or individuals that you help? How do you build that belief? Because I think you're spot on. Is if you don't have belief and conviction in yourself, and this is just like a very normal, non-professional, personal perspective. You know, if you don't believe in yourself, mm-hmm. how do you expect somebody else to believe in you?
Yeah.
So yeah. I'm curious how you've sort of overcome that, or are there any models or frameworks or the way you approach it that...
Yeah. So I think it's really helpful to... I think that having compassion for the target audience that you sell to helps cultivate that belief in the product. Because if you are, you know, really close and connected and empathetic towards the problems that they're experiencing. So in the case of these, you know, treasurers and CFOs, like, their ass is on the line if the company's money, you know, falls in value, disappears, they lose some, like, that does not reflect well on them. It is stressful. And I had a lot of compassion for these guys because that's not, you know, that's just not a fun job. And so that compassion allowed me to cultivate the belief in the service that we were providing. Right now, with the people that I serve, I have a lot of compassion for people who are really good at what they do, but they don't know how to effectively communicate it, or they don't know how to ask for the sale because it's hard and I've been there. And so I really love the people that I work with and the people that I serve. And that allows me to cultivate the belief in the service that I'm providing. And I think that's kind of what I would, how I would approach it, or how I would recommend others to approach it. If you're selling a medical device or whatever, you know, you might not yourself have ever used it, but I'm sure you've seen the lives that it's impacted. And that's, you know, like, that's a way to cultivate the belief in the product.
You know, there's an article that you wrote, which is like has definitely a dotted line or a direct line to what you just said. And I found that to be a very different and fresh perspective. I've never heard of that. I mean, heuristically and sort of, it's intuitively, you kind of are aware of it, but not consciously, maybe.
Yeah.
And you talked about this idea of what makes you good at sales and your, like, mm-hmm. commitment.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to talk a little bit about how compassion and sort of commitment played and what you were trying to get at in that article?
Totally. So I think in a lot of the articles that I write and a lot of the things that I talk about relating to sales, I want people to remember that anyone can be good at sales. I really believe that we all have the capacity to be good at it. I don't think that good salespeople are just, you know, super charismatic and really extroverted and pushy. Like, you know, I think that that's sort of what, I think that's the image that a lot of people cultivate. But I think that in my experience, the most important attributes are having that commitment, which I sort of talked about earlier, because that's what enables you to do hard things. It's what enables you to put yourself out there, to handle rejection, and to keep going. And then having compassion. You've got to, this is not about, it's about liking the people that you're selling to enough so that you genuinely want to help them, because that is just so powerful and that's attractive. Who does not want to speak with someone who likes them, who believes in them, who finds value in what they're doing and wants to support them? Who doesn't want to be around that? That's a really powerful and compelling energy to put out there. And so that's kind of the role that I find. You can't do that if you don't have compassion, and you can't do that if you don't have commitment. And those are two things that are, like, those are, you know, at the core of what it means to be human. And so anyone, you know, anyone who really puts their mind to it could be good at sales. You don't have to, I'm an introvert. Like, I'm not extroverted. But I'm still good at sales.
For a person who is trying to sell a service or a product or themselves, how can they step into the shoes of a CFO and have compassion and empathy for that person without even knowing what that person's day-to-day looks like? Like, there's such a huge disconnect between what the life of a CEO looks like, or a CFO, or a CTO.
Mm-hmm.
So what would be your recommendations or learnings or insights into helping other people make a mental map of, okay, this is the person, this is their worldview, this is what their day-to-day looks like. How do you do that?
Yeah, that's it. I mean, it's a great point. And I don't think you can possibly right. make a sale unless you are intimately aware of what the day-to-day is, what their challenges are, what their before and after is. And so I think there is a lot of focus on, people spend a lot of time focusing on like the details of the sale. And I actually think that that's not that compelling. What's important is like, what was their life like before? And what will it be like after the sale, regardless of what you're selling? And I think as a salesperson, that's what you have to know. You have to have a really, really vivid picture of their day-to-day, their struggles, what they want. It's kind of like you're never selling a plane ticket, you're selling the destination. And that's sort of, you know, that's your job. Your job is to understand what the destination is, where they're leaving. And if you don't know that, then sales will be much harder. And so for me, it was having a lot of conversations. I sell through conversation. And so I'm always talking to prospects, to my ideal clients. Right now, they're no longer banking clients. They are primarily coaches, consultants, financial advisors. So not treasury management, but anyway, doesn't matter. But I spend a lot of time talking to them, understanding what are you struggling with most? What are your prospects telling you? I think that's the big thing, because there often is a disconnect. I find a lot of people who are good at what they do, they are trying to sell what they believe the solution is, or they position their offer, what they're selling, within the context of what they believe the solution is for their client. But you know, sometimes the client or prospect, like, they're just so in the weeds that they have, like, that's not what they want. And so there can be a disconnect there. It's kind of like what you said earlier. It's sort of sell them what they want, give them what they need. It's all in the positioning.
Love it. This is really, really cool. What surprised me is that this is sort of partly going off tangent for just a quick hot second.
I love a good tangent.
Is we often connect someone's intel, and this is not like a broad generalized statement or anything, but I've noticed this quite often, is sometimes when somebody can speak multiple languages, right, they might not necessarily be like an A plus in each language. So mm-hmm. if, let's say, English is not their primary, but they're in an English context, sometimes people view their intelligence based on if they can speak that language. Mm-hmm. And why I say that is because the language of sales and selling, if you don't know, it's like another skill. It's got nothing to do with your core skill set of, you know, whether you're a dentist or, you know, whatever coach you are. Mm-hmm. Selling is a different language. So, and we often judge ourselves and our IQ because we can't sell, but it's a completely different language you have to know.
Totally. Yeah. It's a whole, and you know what I think is really interesting and what I find so cool about sales in general, like a lot of sales training, they teach it as though it's a process. Like, here are the steps. This is the cycle. This is the buyer's journey. This is your sales cycle. And they teach sales like it's a process. But it's not, it's a practice, you know, it's both. It is the practice of showing up every single day and like having your sort of mental checklist of, so for example, in a sales conversation, there's a huge push to having scripts for everything. And this isn't acting, this is improv. You have no idea what the other person is going to say. And if you get so attached to the script, it can really mess up great salespeople. I've fallen victim to that before. I worked with someone who insisted I use a script. So I'm like, all right, if you say so, I followed the script. And it was a terrible conversation because I got so in my head about following the script that I just couldn't have a human conversation. I couldn't listen. I couldn't respond to the you know, to their needs. And so I lost my train of thought. Sorry. No. I got so into the script and my rant. I forgot where I was going.
No, I think this is beautiful because it leads us to another really helpful topic is what if we were to ask ourselves or if I was to ask you a very basic question, what is sales according to you?
I like that. Well, I could give you my cheesy answer, which I used to say a long time ago, which was like, oh, sales is helping people. But you know, and I think in a way it is that, but for me, sales is passionately advocating for my services. So, or for the service that I believe in. And so if it right now happens to be sales support, and to me, that's what it is. Like, I really view myself as an advocate for the client that I'm working with because I feel so strongly about the huge importance of sales. I mean, nobody goes into business to not make money. Or if you do, I don't know why you're in business. You should have a 9-to-5. But, you know, if you're not making money, if you need that help, I just, you know, I believe in that it's fundamental to what business is. And so, yeah, for me, it's this sort of passionate advocacy for the service that I believe in.
Right. Interesting. I always get a different answer.
What's your definition?
I think it's definitely a work in progress. And I feel that my definition evolves and changes every now and then. But for now, philosophically, sales to me means being an eternal blue belt. Mm. Is you're just curious.
Yeah.
And it's not just something that I'm doing at the beginning or at the end or in the middle somewhere. Mm-hmm. It's just who I am. And if you sort of look at the butterfly effect, if that's where you're coming from, mm-hmm. then it just keeps up. It just keeps opening up. And then you don't know where you can help. And then when you start doing that, then it opens up another can of things. And then, then you can bring in like more complexity, like, okay, cost of acquisition. Yeah. Because the more curious you are, then that can shrink down because you're not going down paths that don't. Then you can look at the lifetime value because now over time you're delivering more value. Mm-hmm. So this idea of like this little seed of eternal blue belt really for me captures that. But again, this is a work in progress. This might change.
Oh, I love that. I do think I think the most effective sort of approach to sales is driven by curiosity. 100%. Yeah. You have to be so curious and have a healthy obsession about the people you're selling to.
Obsession. Check.
Yeah. Healthy obsession.
He's very passionate. Okay, cool. So I think I think you were talking about, you know, the not having scripts and stuff.
Yeah.
I was reading a LinkedIn post like a couple of days ago and it talked about, I don't know who this was. I think this girl who was at Lavender, I forgot her name. I read some LinkedIn post, but she was talking about, you know, we constantly hire sales representatives and we really spend like 5 days on onboarding and training them. And this can perfectly parlay into, you know, the work that, let's say you're doing with people who do service-based work, coaches, et cetera, is in the beginning, when you're just starting out, and let's say when you were starting out, there's not only the psychological piece that you're dealing with, rejection, which is so hard. Especially if you've had like a really good upbringing and your parents gave you everything, you're like, life's amazing. Till you hear a no. But where I was going with this was, that in that initial phase, when you're dealing with this and then this other thing and then this other thing, maybe there is some merit of using some level of scripts to kind of get you started, to give you some sort of scaffolding.
Yeah.
And then find a way to take the training wheels off at some point in that journey.
Yeah, I think you're right. And I also think that a 5-day onboarding period for a salesperson is not enough. Like, that's not enough. So you should tell your friend at Lavender that they might want to reassess that. But I think, you know, a lot of people, there has been this shift towards selling through authority, selling by expertise. And you can't do that if you are not an authority or an expert in what you're selling. And so I think oftentimes with the people that I'm working with, because they're selling themselves, because they're selling a service that they deliver, they know, like, they're really, you know, they're very comfortable with that element of it. And that is just so important. So they, you know, they won't necessarily need a script to help them. But I think I'm a big fan of frameworks versus scripts. And it's just because it's the difference. Like, are you running a call center, or, you know, do you have a team of salespeople? There, to me, there's a difference. And I like the idea of having a framework to guide the conversation. The script can act as such a security blanket, giving them some sample questions to ask. I'm comfortable doing scripts for, like, things like outreach. You know, if you're doing manual outreach and you are sending, you know, 10 emails to get people on the phone, like, sure, have a script for that. That makes sense. But in a two-way communication environment, I think that having a framework in terms of what are, you know, what is the flow of a good sales conversation or an effective sales conversation is better than relying on a script, even for newbies.
I love this overarching idea of what does a good flow look like?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, like, that's what you should be aiming for. Now, what are the ingredients required?
Yes.
Here are some of the ingredients. And this is typically
how there are sample questions. Yeah, exactly.
This is typically how we make the recipe, but go have fun.
Yeah.
And it's okay to fail. I really like that. That because once you kind of give people, instead of telling them, ask this question, then they're just stuck. Okay, when do I ask this question? Okay. Mm-hmm. And then it seems like the question is coming out of context. And I see this so many times.
Totally.
In the emails that come to me, they're like, they just jump right into, I think you need this. I'm like, what? And the question just comes out of left field. and you're like, wait, weren't we talking about?
Yeah, because it's like, oh no, that comes next in the script. I must, instead of, like, you know what I mean? Or like, it also, listening is just so important as a salesperson. You have to, like, really hear what your prospects are saying. But if you're so focused on, like, okay, so I just asked you that, like, someone has given you this, you know, crazy piece of information and you don't even react to it. You're like, so, and you just move on to the next question. Like, it's just, you're like, who am I talking to right now? What is this? So I don't scripts.
Yeah. I think we got that tight. Yeah, I think because depending on the resolution of question you're asking, the client's going to reveal so much.
Absolutely.
And the question will also tell the clients, like, you know, from the subtext perspective, mm-hmm. what your level of expertise is, because mm-hmm. you're almost going in, look, the client, the person you're talking to, if they feel like, is this person bugged my office? How do they know so much about that success?
Yes.
That's absolutely. How you're demonstrating expertise.
Yeah. Yes.
That's just sort of.
By really good questions. Absolutely. Not by telling them all of these different things. It's by asking really good questions. I love that.
Yeah. So, okay. So that was really cool. I loved poking around into some of those pieces. Now, I think since we've sort of reached the halfway point of the conversation mm-hmm. and we've kind of gone a little bit broad, we've touched on a few other elements.
Yeah.
And what I would love to do for the next half of the conversation, and hopefully we can bring you back and have more conversations, because there's endless rabbit holes
to explore.
I know. Is a lot of the work that you're currently doing, mm-hmm. I would want to talk more about that and how some of the past experiences of, like, getting on a phone, talking to a CFO, building, having compassion and empathy and some of the elements that you talked about before, and having commitment. which mm-hmm. which I thought was like a, it seems so obvious now that I read it from on your article.
Yeah.
But it didn't seem obvious consciously before.
Yeah.
But you have, but now I'm like, yeah, of course, duh. So, I wanted to start bringing the conversation towards, okay, let's think of some scenarios. I can get us started with scenario one. So let's say we have one of your potential students or clients. What do you call them?
Clients.
Okay. So let's say we have one of your clients and they are a coach.
Yeah.
Now, what does that initial conversation look like for you? And what are the mm-hmm. common problems that you see with these coaches? And then, okay, let me give one more additional piece. This will be helpful for the audience listening as well. Is so if you're a coach or if you're a person who is service-based, you're a freelancer, contractor.
Yes.
And you're trying to think of, okay, how do I put together a landing page? How do I even begin selling my services?
Yeah.
And sorry, one quick other tangent. I'm adding so many layers here. This is becoming like a multi-layered cake. But I think if I was to like simply, I was having a conversation with somebody else and I was like, you know, the main difference between people who are making money and us is a sales page. Mm. Like, how does somebody know that you do this and you can help them? How do they know?
Yeah.
You need a freaking sales page.
You need something.
Right. So having said that, what are the common mistakes that you see? And then how can we help this person who's listening and their potential, you know, they are service-based. It's they're using their brain to make money.
Yes.
How can we help them go from 0.0 today to in the next 45 minutes, help them get to a point where they're like, yep, I think I know what I need to do.
I love this question for a couple of reasons. I think that I see because, you know, the use of technology in the sales process and in sales has increased so much since I started selling. And I find it a barrier to a lot of people who are either newbies or who are kind of at the like, in the case of coaches and consultants, people who are making 80 to 150 grand a year in revenue. And I see it as a barrier because they're almost like, oh God, you know, I can't sell because I don't have a landing page, because I don't have an email marketing system set up, because I don't have, you know, all of this technology things which they've heard you need or which help your sales life. They think that they need those. And so then it becomes a barrier to selling. And, you know, at the end of the day, all you need to sell is your brain and your heart and some form of some medium to communicate with people. And then of course, you know, a way to accept payment. But if you're in business, I'm sure you have that already. That's my hope for you. But that's all that you need. Like, we don't need to overcomplicate it. You need your brain and your heart and a phone or a computer. That's what you need. And landing pages, websites, those are all great. But I think for a lot of people starting out, especially coaches and consultants, you're not selling to a cold audience. You're not. You are selling to a warm audience, or at least that's what I'm going to recommend that you do, because selling to a warm audience versus a cold audience, way easier, way more satisfying initially. Let's focus there. this is like a walk before you run type of thing. And so I think, you know, what I would recommend, and the biggest problem that I see is people viewing technology as this barrier that they need to have. They view it as a barrier to sales. You don't need that. And then also getting in their head about who they're selling to. A lot of the people that I work with, they have extensive networks, yet they're putting posts on LinkedIn or social, thinking that that's where their next sale is going to come from. And I see so much value and so much immediate lift in people reviewing their contact list, reviewing their network, identifying, you know, 20 names of people who would be a good fit for whatever you're selling and reaching out to them. And it's simple. It's like, hey, I thought of you the other day. I just wanted to let you know what I'm doing. I'd love, you know, to hop on the phone or whatever. And this is not a cold lead. This is someone warm who's in your network. I'm sure in my experience, they'll get on the phone with you. And then that's who you're selling to. You're not selling to these cold people that are going to visit your landing page and all of a sudden convert. That's the advice. Any coach or consultant who's listening right now, that's what I would do. I would mine your existing network. I would pick out people who would be a good fit. I would send them outreach. I would get on the phone and I would talk to them about your offer.
One thing that you sort of glossed over, but I found that really funny is like, you know, we have like this massive FOMO and this hamster wheel of, okay, I need to start making like this 10 pieces of content like Gary yes. Vaynerchuk.
Yes, I know. Yeah.
And
yeah.
And it kind of falls under this umbrella of like what I call like only if I had a landing page, only if I had this much money, only if I yes. had X.
Yes. Yeah, totally.
Right. So let me just sort of summarize it if I've understood this in the right way. The first thing that you talked about high level was that you need the brain and the heart. Mm-hmm. And that's basically compassion and commitment.
Yeah.
And then a way to communicate what you do. And so yes. the advocacy part that you talked about earlier in the conversation. Other pieces, being able to accept money. So very simple. And then from there, you know, you have that trunk and you can now start branching off into, okay, what do you need to do?
That's all you actually need to sell. You know, like you don't need a website. I don't have a landing page. And somehow I still sell. Could I sell more with a landing page? Sure. But for now, I don't need to.
I love these edge cases. I wouldn't even call this actually an edge case. This is actually so true, even in my own personal journey. And then the other piece that you talked about is that instead of going down to the FOMO hamster wheel of start making all this content and, you know, using up your precious time because you have limited time. So obviously you're dividing up that time partly for business development and partly for actually doing the work. We'll get into some of those details in a second. That what your outbound and all that stuff looks like. A low-hanging fruit and a great starting point is what is a cold lead versus a warm lead? And then maybe yeah. describe that process of what's the right way to do an outreach or like
yeah.
in a simple English is like, okay, who am I calling? Who is the yeah. right, who are the right 10 people to call to get the ball rolling? And
I notice variances in how people describe leads. I think it can depend company to company, but in broad strokes, I sort of classify people as leads, prospects, customers, clients. And so when I think about a lead, a cold lead, it could be someone who is new to your brand, new to your company, new to your work. Maybe they're an opt-in that, you know, that you got through one of your lead magnets. Maybe they heard you speak and they liked what they heard, so they've signed up for your newsletter. But it's someone who is very early on in their buyer's journey. So to me, that's kind of like a cold lead. You haven't had a conversation. There hasn't been a lot of interaction, maybe none, but they've come into your world somehow. They've found you somehow. To me, that's a cold lead. A warm lead is someone who is further along in their buyer's journey. So this would be someone who's problem aware. They are solution aware. So they know what they know what's wrong. They know what they need to do. And you've had some, you know, perhaps you've had some two-way engagement. So there's some back and forth on some of your social posts or some of their social posts. They've responded to one of your newsletters. They've reached out to in some capacity, or maybe they've even reached out for a call. When they've reached out for a call, when they've kind of taken that next step into consideration, then that becomes a prospect. So that's how I view them and define them. Yeah. What was the other part of your question?
By the way, how much does like referral and relationship play into all this?
I mean, it's a lot. So I think I do a lot of relationship building online. And so I am commenting on people's posts, I'm engaging with their content. And so I think that that's an important part of social selling and an important part of relationship building. So it is, it's big, you know, I want them to see my name and I want them to experience, interactions with me that are outside the sales process, or might seem outside, like it's all part of the sales process, but it seems outside because I'm not talking about myself. I'm engaging with them and their content. So yeah.
And I think that would obviously vary, depending on new relationship versus existing relationship. And
yes.
So.
Yeah.
Making an assumption here, right? So the cold lead would be new relationship. Somebody just discovers a post from you and they're like, oh shit, this resonates versus somebody that you've worked with in the past or somebody you worked in the past. They go to a new company and they're like, oh, I know this person.
Yeah. So pre-existing relationship, warm. Don't know you from, you know, Joe Blow on the street.
Yeah.
Cold.
Yeah. So then the question here then would be, or for this person listening, trying to figure out, okay, I want to start a coaching business. What are the indicators I'm looking at to know that this is going to be a warm lead, AKA this is the kind of relationship I need to be having for this to be a warm lead who I can pick up the phone and reach out to? Is there a way that you could think about that framework around that?
I mean, I don't really overcomplicate it. It's people that I have, that I've spoken to before in some capacity. Yeah. That's just kind of how I broadly define it. But I think the big thing is, there's warm and then there's fit. And so, you know, I think when I look at my warm network, or what I did when I started the business was I looked at my warm network, AKA my connections on LinkedIn. I thought about who would buy this. Who needs this offer? Who needs this service? And I had a list of like 50 people and I just kind of reached out to them one by one. And that's sort of how I started selling this new service. And so, you know, there's the warm leads, but then they have to be the right leads. Otherwise, don't waste your time or theirs.
My guess is there's like a pre-step one, which is, okay, what is my offer? What do I want to sell?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And I developed that by asking those people who I eventually sold to. I'm like, what would be helpful for you? What do you need? And asking them questions about the types of things that they really needed, the type of support that they want. And then I crafted my offer around that. Because why assume, you know, like go straight to the source. Ask them what they need. That's how I developed my offer. And then I went back to them and sold it to them.
That's actually brilliant. So step one is literally pick up the phone or reach out to people that you know, that you've spoken to before.
Yeah.
Just and so basically you're getting on a call and just finding out. You're being curious.
Yes.
Being that eternal blue belt and being an advocate of sort of what you do.
Yeah.
And you're finding out, okay, what are their pain points? What are the challenges? And then you go back and build a custom offer for them. Again, I'm making an assumption here. Maybe it's like a couple of conversations that you have and you find, okay, what's the common pattern and how could I maybe productize my service to them?
Totally. Yeah. That's kind of like a step two. You know what I mean? So I think you can apply this technique to whether you are kind of early on in your entrepreneurial career, because a lot of times you are selling customized offers. And then I know that a lot of more established entrepreneurs no longer need to sell customized offers because after serving so many people, they see that kind of connective thread or the connective tissue, the sort of framework of the work that they've been doing, and they're able to productize it into a high touch package service, for example. But you kind of need one before the other, you know, you do have to work with a number of people to be able to get that intel, that market intel. But that is what I would recommend. I think so many people spend so much time in the product development phase without even talking to the people who are going to be buying the product. It's insane. Like, go and talk to them, find out what they need, then develop the product or offer, and then sell it to them.
Again, I think this is philosophically, you're so focused on what you're selling versus what they're buying. Now, how do you actually get them to buy that? Is there like some like 0.01, 0.02, 0.03 steps?
Yeah. I mean, in the case of what I did, they were already primed to buy because I knew that these were people who they were like my ideal fit. I had talked to them and already sort of prefaced them with like, hey, this is what I'm thinking of offering, but I'd love to hear from you. What would you find most helpful? So I already have established need. I even asked them about budget. I'm like, okay. And like, what is, you know, what would you be willing to pay for something like this? Because, you know, sometimes there can be a huge discrepancy with what you want to charge and what the market is willing, what the market will bear. And so I wanted to use that as a guide. So I kind of already knew they needed and were interested in what I had to sell. And so then I just got on the phone with them again. I'm like, hey, I thought a lot about our previous conversation. I've actually crafted an offer with you specifically in mind. I think I could support your revenue growth to the tune of $100,000 over a period of 12 months. I'm really excited to talk to you about this. Let's connect. We did. And that's kind of where, like, that's how I got them on the phone again. That's how I pitched the offer. And that's how I landed the client.
Oh, I like that too, because you're connecting. Here's the outcome you're going to get. Mm-hmm. And then you're connecting the price to that, to the value that you're bringing versus like, this is what it's going to cost.
These are all the works. Here's the deliverable. You know what I mean? Like, no one cares about that. They care about where you're taking them.
Yeah. So do you want to speak a little bit about, okay, what is the common mistake that you see people making, and then how this is the, how they can do this?
Yeah. I mean, I see so many mistakes, but I guess within the context of this, the mistake
pricing,
that I see,
talking money.
Yeah.
That's where we started the conversation.
Totally. Yes, exactly. So, I mean, I think, pricing is a huge problem. It's also something so many entrepreneurs struggle with. They have no idea how to price their offer. And, you know, pricing is very personal. It's very personal, but, and this is, you know, a tangent of my own. I really hate when people are like, oh, charge what you're worth, because your worth, you know, does not change. Like, it's always, your worth is your worth. What you charge and your price, that is a reflection of value. And so you have to be so clear about the value that you are going to be providing. And when you sell a service, it's intangible. No one can test drive it. You know, they're kind of going off of your good reputation. You know, any testimonials or any previous case studies that you can demonstrate a proven success and track record, but you have to be able to paint such a vivid picture for them about what they're getting. And if you can't do that, like, it's the promise. It's the promise of your offer. If you cannot articulate that, you're in trouble. And so I think, you know, there's lots of things that you have to be clear about before you can sell effectively. And so, and that's a big part of it. And clarity is just so powerful.
Is there like an example you can think of or an incident where you're like, you know, this is how this person was doing it, and then I helped them go and think about it like this, and then that actually helped close the deal? Maybe that's asking.
Yeah. No, that's a great question. So let me think of a recent example. I worked with someone who was, they were selling basically social media support. So they were helping other business owners get more bang for their buck on social media, just increase their reach and their target audience, blah, blah, blah. And there is the way that they were talking about the support that they provided, all of their marketing was incredibly tactical. It was like, here are the checklists, and this is how you, you know, this is how you grow a Facebook list. Or it was just really, really tactical stuff. But a lot of the conversations that she was having with her clients were about their discomfort going live on social, or their discomfort about, what do I even post? I have so many things to say, but I don't know where to start, and what platform should I be on? And so what she was actually giving them was kind of a sounding board, and the expertise and the mindset work that was required to post consistently. Like, anyone can go and Google how to do the tactics, right? Like, that's everywhere, all over the internet. But what she was providing was the inner work. Like, the real value that she was providing was that was cultivating the inner work required to show up so visibly and powerfully. And when we made that shift, that's what actually allowed her to charge higher pricing. Because why would you pay for something you get for free off the internet? You can't get that support to a lot of that sort of mindset work or thought partnership. You can't just get from a checklist off of the internet. That's kind of the magic of what she was selling. So that shift in positioning was a good example of being able to articulate that promise in a more meaningful way to help close the deal or charge higher pricing.
That's a beautiful story. I have goosebumps, by the way. Not kidding. This is why I love what we do. I think to change the frame of, this is not what you're selling, this is what you're selling, and this is what they're buying. And then the gap between what they think they, what their value was versus what their value is. Yes. I think you covered so many such crucial elements in that one story. I'm actually gonna go on a limb here and ask if there's another story you could share. That would be really awesome.
Wow, the pressure's on. I don't know if I can think of another one off the top of my head. I don't know if I have a specific story, but I do, you know, I do notice that a lot of people, they kind of miss out on what pops in a sales conversation or in sort of in sales related content, because they're really quite focused on sharing what they have to offer versus the what's in it for me from the point of their prospect. And so, yeah, I just see that as, I see that all the time as just such a huge missed opportunity. And it can happen with people who are experts in what they do. They have so much experience. Like, you live, breathe, and sleep this, you know, this one particular thing. And so you're always thinking about it. But I think you have to be so cognizant of the awareness level of your buyer. Right? Like, these people are all going through their buyer's journey. You're moving them along this continuum of awareness. And so you need to be able to communicate to them and position your value as, like, in terms of their problems at the end of the day, right? Like, that's kind of what I find most effective. And a lot of people don't like doing that because they don't like to talk about the negative. Just want to keep it fluffy, you know, like, they don't want to talk about the negative, and they don't like tapping into pain because it makes them feel uncomfortable. And so a lot of salespeople won't do it. And it's such a missed opportunity.
That was like the climax of this conversation. You touched on something. Shit.
I used to do that. I used to, like, I had people, you know, because I was selling. This is before I had my own business, but I was selling an offer that it was basically an incubator program for women entrepreneurs. And so the people that were coming into this program, or the people that were attracted to it, were people who, women who had started their own business, but they were just so strapped for time that they felt really overwhelmed. They felt lonely. It was really quite emotional because, you know, business is personal, even though we say it's not, it is. And oftentimes, like, in my conversations, they would sometimes cry, and I hated that. I hated it because I was like, I wanted to keep it up here. I wanted to go straight to the solution. And my trainer, my sales trainer at the time was like, you have got to get down there with them. Like you have, you've got to sort of allow them to feel that pain because that's a powerful motivator. It's like, how long are we going to tolerate this pain? Like I'm here for you, but like, you know what I mean? So if you can't allow yourself to go deep in those conversations, yeah, it's not, you know, you're going to be missing a lot of opportunity.
And I think there's a little bit of a nuance here because I think you instinctively just toggled between mm-hmm. the two states. Is I think there's the cost of inaction from the client perspective.
Yes.
If they don't do this, what could happen? And then totally. The other piece is the fear of the person trying to sell.
Yeah.
Then not wanting to say anything negative because,
yes.
you know, especially in large scale deals, when they're stretched over multi-years mm-hmm. or even smaller projects, you know, sometimes things can go wrong. You know, the
yeah.
server could crash at the wrong time when people are trying to go from this ad campaign to a call to action, whatever.
Yeah. Yeah.
But things can go wrong. And then how you deal with those gives the client comfort, confidence, trust. It, yeah. it like settles them because one side of it is the pain of not doing anything and mm-hmm. also the piece to do with your reputation and trust of how you handle critical, difficult situations. I think there's like these sort of the side of the person selling the thing mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. to the side of the person buying the thing and they're experiencing pain.
Yes.
In different four-dimensional ways, I would say, each.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah, 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 totally. And I think that just kind of goes back to the whole sort of compassion and empathy piece. Like you have to have that. You have to just demonstrate to them that you will be able, like that you'll be able to help. That's kind of like at the end of the day, what you're doing, but you need to let them feel their feelings.
Yeah. Yeah. I think there's definitely some merit in, when no one's around, when everybody's gone away and you're at the nth hour and it's critical time. Okay. We're going to be there. Don't worry. Like that mm-hmm. piece. Obviously it depends on the level and scope of engagement that we're looking at. Is there something that is critical to this that's missing so far?
The final piece is like digging into what is a compelling offer and how do you have a good sales conversation? Like, I think those are two really key foundational pieces for people who are in sales. And so when I think about, you know, what is a compelling offer, it has three components. There's the offer itself, whatever it is that you're selling. There's a bonus and a limiter. And so I hate when people just kind of give an offer and they just throw it out into the ecosystem. And then it's just placing so much power into the hands of the prospect because it's like, okay, I'll hear from you when I hear from you. No, that's not how offers are made. So I think you need to have a bonus and a limiter. And so the bonus could be anything that is attractive to the buyer that incentivizes them to make a decision. And the limiter is the time frame that you allow them to consider the offer. And I think you have to have those three components every time you make an offer. And if you don't, you're kind of sentencing yourself to a lot of unnecessary ambiguity around the closing of the sale. And sales hates ambiguity. So do prospects, right? They like clarity it's kind of like a sales boundary. Like, you know, this offer isn't going to last forever. So I think, you know, an example of that is I have a client who extends everybody a 15% discount on his service. And that's just something that he does. And so I told him, I was like, look, I would love to see that when you present your offer, you present what it is that you are going to be doing for them. And then you say, I'd like you to take, you know, 2 weeks or a week to consider this. I don't like going longer than 2 weeks unless there's a really good reason. But a week to 2 weeks to just do consider this, but be concise, give them either like 5 or 10 days to consider. And if you get back to me before that, I'm happy to extend you a 15% fee reduction or whatever. And so that's his bonus. And the limiter is the time frame that he's given to the client, to the prospect, to make a decision. It could be whatever. I have another client that offers a free, one-on-one coaching session to these people who sign up for her group program if they decide to sign up before such and such a date. But I think any compelling offer, whenever you're making an offer, you have to have a time limit on it. And you have to, sometimes people need like a little extra something to get them moving. Those are really juicy components. Like that is the, those are the ingredients for a very compelling offer. And so I think that's like a tactical piece that I think a lot of people would find helpful. And then just in general, like the general flow of a sales conversation, I think there needs to be some table setting. And that's just kind of like setting expectations. And obviously you have your pleasantries, but then you're like, okay, so this is my goal for the conversation, and you state your goal. And then you check in with them. And I think that's important. Like continuously checking in with a prospect is that's kind of a best practice. Then you're fact finding, then you're uncovering, you're clear about the information that you need to know, because it's the information that these are the buying triggers. That's what you're doing in your kind of fact finding. You're like asking them questions about the information they need to move forward. And then you diagnose. So I'm often like, I use that time to repeat back what I've heard them say. I really kind of, I don't gloss over the pain points. I think it's an important area to stay in and talk about. And then I kind of move into positioning the offer. And I think that is sort of the framework of a really effective sales conversation. And then I'm going to give one more piece, because I'm kind of, I am obsessed with sort of tips and tricks to make people better salespeople. Oftentimes I will use a multiple conversation close. Like I'm not closing people on the first call. So it's like one or two calls to close, but I will never leave a sales call without having my second sales call booked, ever. Do not hang up that phone until you have the second sales call booked, because it's so hard to then go back and forth via email or send them your booking link. So you never leave the scene of a sales call without your next sales call book if you haven't closed the sale. And that concludes my TED Talk on, on tips and tricks and tactics for being a better salesperson.
Standing ovation. I'm standing. I think as you were describing sort of the process, one element that we could expand on is,
yeah,
often people will actually, hold on, let me reframe the whole thing. So okay, you were talking about noticing buying signals. So
yeah,
one is, what are those buying signals that the client is giving you that you need to pick up?
Mm-hmm.
And the reason I'm asking that is because a lot of times the client's saying, I'm ready to buy, let me sign the dotted line. And then you're still talking about features and things. It's like, when do you talk and when do you shut up?
Yeah.
And not talk yourself out of a sale.
Yeah. Oh, that's a great one. And I've definitely been there. So, I mean, like, this will obviously depend on what you're selling. But I think there's a couple of things. So in my current conversations, I know the pieces of information that I need to have for them or from them in order to kind of present those buying triggers. And so I need to know how much revenue they're making. I need to know what their revenue goal is. I need to know how close they are to achieving it. I need to know the types of activities that they're doing to generate revenue. Those are kind of the informational pieces that I have to have. The buying triggers are, when I hear them, honestly, it's like it's things that allude to frustration. Anytime that I hear exasperation or frustration around what they've done, but what hasn't panned out, that to me is a buying signal, because I know that there is a need and there's a lot of emotion associated with it. And I think that's a kind of a key piece. Like, to me, the buying signals are the emotions that your prospect has around their situation or problem, because that's, that is such an important piece of purchasing and purchasing decisions. It's the emotion that they feel. So to me, that's a really big one. Because I kind of view it as like the must have versus nice to have. Does that make sense? Like the level or the degree of emotion that they feel, that I'm able to pick up on, that they express, really it indicates the amount of the urgency that they might feel towards making a decision. And so those are kind of the buying signals that I'm looking for.
Now, as an experienced person, you could probably read between the lines, understand what is being said, what is not being said. And you can pick up on some of those cues, whether that those are, they just can't shut up. They just keep talking and they're opening about things that they even might start telling you about their personal challenges.
Oh, always. Yeah.
Right. And it's like, what level of comfort are you giving them? So you're probably picking that up. But for a newbie, for somebody who's just this person that's listening and who's starting their business.
Yeah.
Are there key phrase words or subtle things in your experience that you're like, oh, wait, I see what's happening here?
Yeah. So I think anytime people are asking about next steps or price or, how soon can we get started? Like those are buying signals. And I would stop presenting the offer, the features and the benefits, and I would move into like wrapping it up and getting that close. So I think, those kind of specific things, there's not a lot of nuance to, okay, how much does it cost? When can we get started? What do next steps look like? Those are all fairly obvious buying signals, but they weren't obvious to me at the time. Like when I first started, it was not right.
I love it. So for the person listening, I think those are really good starting points. You know, if they start asking about, okay, next steps, how will you solve this problem? Or they ask about price or all that stuff. I think those are really good, obvious indicators. Obviously, with experience, you learn a lot more about these and how these are verbalized, and sort of depending on the kind of person you're talking to, they're probably going to wrap it into something else. Reading some of your articles, and somewhere it said, asking money for yourself.
Yeah, that was the shift that I made after I started my own business. So I built my career selling things for other people. And then when I moved into B2C sales and I was selling high ticket coaching, I was selling the coaching services of somebody else. And so I was always in an experience where I was selling on behalf of someone, or selling a service that I personally didn't necessarily deliver. And I felt really comfortable doing that. I felt really comfortable asking, I think the highest the highest ticket coaching package I ever sold was about $50,000. And I was like, yeah, cool. Like I can do that. And then I started selling for myself and there was like a little bit of imposter syndrome because I had never been in an experience where I was selling something. I was selling me. I was like, what the client was buying was me, my expertise, my professional reputation. And that I was really nervous about it. Not so nervous I couldn't do it, But it was a weird feeling because, you know, I guess I took for granted being in this industry for 20 years. I was like, oh yeah, like nothing can faze me. And then I started selling my own expertise. And I'm like, oh God, who's going to buy this? Why are they going to listen to me? You know, like I had those thoughts. So it was a little nerve wracking. It lasted for about 24 hours and then I got over it.
By the way, how similar was that experience when you started selling for yourself versus when you were doing those first calls to sell the treasury thing? How similar were those?
Yeah, so that feeling in my gut was the same, that like initial gut feeling that I had when I was scared or nervous. It was the same. The thing that really helped me was just the fact that I knew I could do this, you know, like I know that I could sell anything. And so that previous experience did help. But the feeling was the same and it was still shit. It just lasted way less than it did the first time.
Because I think there's I think you did talk about this, that belief is very critical. But I think the difference, and I'm again just thinking off on a tangent here, when you're trying to sell for someone else, you are basically not on the line. But
no,
right? You're like, well, they didn't like this product. It's got nothing to do with me.
That's, you know, customer service's problem. That's right? Like delivery. Yeah.
But when you're selling yourself, you're like, maybe there's something wrong with me.
My butt is on the line. Yeah. Totally. Yeah. And it's interesting. The rejection was easier. Like the rejection when you're selling for someone else is a bit easier to take. I haven't had to handle the rejection yet when I've been selling, you know, my own services. I know it's coming, but I haven't had to handle it yet. And it might be a tougher pill to swallow. I'm not sure. I'll let you know when that happens. But I am pretty good at not taking things too personally.
That's good. I think that's critical, to detach yourself from the thing that you're doing versus who you are as a person.
Yeah. And I also think that, I think too, that there's this healthy level of detachment from, the outcome. Because everyone, obviously you want to close the sale, but you have no control over what they decide to do. You can influence it. You can, you know, cross all your T's and dot your I's, but you do. I really needed to become attached to my actions and not to the outcome. So I became very attached to making sure it was a really good, seamless, like logical experience for them. But then I also had to become good at kind of detaching or not attaching myself to whether they said yes or no. And just knowing that, like, I did everything that I could have done to close the sale and it didn't close, and that's okay.
Right.
Next. You know, yeah. It's like on to the next one. Like, that's just also a powerful word in sales. Being able to move on.
Yeah, because I think whoever wants it more can't control the sale. If you, if you're like going like, please give this to me, I want this bad.
Desperation. Yeah.
Anyway, whoever shows desperation can't control the, if you want to lead and guide and control the conversation, quote unquote, control. But you can't
guide the flow. Yeah.
Yeah. You can't come from a place of scarcity and desperation.
No, that's a great point. Yeah. That, because that's scary. It's so unappealing. It is so unattractive. It's like that really needy love interest that you had that you're like, go away. You know what I mean? Like the stage 5 clinger. And you're just like, I can feel your desperation and it is not attractive. You know,
I feel
don't
seen
be like that.
We've all been there. I think, you know, especially for guys, you know, if you don't get your heart broken a couple of times, you just can't orient yourself in the right way.
Yeah.
And I've grown up on Bollywood movies and they have
amazing
completely the wrong knowledge. on the subject.
Did they tell you lies?
Yeah, they told all big lies. It looks really cool when, you know, in the movie they do it, but in real life it doesn't work.
No.
Totally. Anyways, so I think that's another thing to keep in mind, especially when you're starting out. Mm-hmm. And this could, I've heard like different variants and versions of this is, how do you avoid showing up with the scarcity or desperation? One is, you know, if you're transitioning from a job to this, firstly, don't quit your job. Build this out. Mm-hmm. You know, if you really look at like tactfully, it's like, okay, have some savings, have a runway. So even if the client says no, you're not like married to the outcome. Because if your mortgage payment is dependent on this client paying you, it's going to be very hard to come off as like, I'm detached from the outcome of this.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Cool detachment. I firmly believe that if you are confident about your offer, the prospect that you're speaking with is a fit and they are qualified, it's really hard to extend an offer that's not going to be accepted. And if it's not accepted, it's just not the right time. It doesn't necessarily, like if you've done your homework and your pre-work, you know that you've established fit and qualification. If they don't accept the offer, then that's on them. And that's just kind of like, that's kind of how the attitude that I have when I go into conversations, like, you know, you have to want to be able to help yourself. And if you don't want to do that, then that's okay. I'll be here for you when you are ready. And that's just kind of how I view it. And I think that that really helped get rid of some of the needy energy. And it was a sales trainer that helped me with that. Like I was exuding needy energy because the company I was working with, they decided to hire 4 additional salespeople. They fired my colleague, and then they made me compete for my job. And we were competing for 3 seats. And so that was a scary time, but it was a great experience. They did bring in an external sales trainer. And I remember at the time I was like really stressed about, closing the most sales in that 30-day period, because I'm like, I not only want to keep my job, I would just want to show everyone that you don't mess with me. And I didn't have a good conversation. And then my sales trainer was like, maybe she just didn't need it. Maybe she wasn't the right one. Like it's not a big deal. And that was just really powerful for me because, that's kind of the attitude that I went into all my future calls. Like, I think if you have that belief in what you're selling, you have the commitment to the process, you know, your sales process, you extend your offer, which has those components. And if it's not accepted, you know, maybe you need the money. There's somebody else. There's always going to be somebody else.
It's good that you had a good, manager/leader in that position.
She was the best. Yeah.
That they guided you because I think giving targets to sales reps or people in sales is the best way to get them become needy.
Yeah, totally.
Those are like at the opposing ends.
Yeah.
Because on one end you have like, I got this freaking target. And then you're like, I gotta freaking sell. And then that's your energy. So I really like the how to get rid of your low vibration, needy energy.
Totally.
Topic of this whole podcast.
Yeah. I mean, I've never bought from a low vibe salesperson. Like that's just not inspiring or exciting.
Totally makes sense. Mm-hmm. Okay, so we've covered a whole bunch of ground and there's definitely, hopefully we'll get you back on more episodes shows. So what we're going to do is, while you think of what are some final words you'd like to tell the audience and leave off with, I'm going to let that question sort of bake and marinate in your brain while do a couple of things. One is we're going to do this fun little activity, 3,000 questions all about me. And I want you to pick a number between 1 and 3,001.
Hmm. 1,996.
Okay, hold on. And so this is the book, by the way.
Amazing.
Okay, hold on.
I like it.
1996, correct? So let me go there. Yeah. 19. Okay. This book has some of the funniest and weirdest questions. Here it is. Okay. What is the quintessential wintertime food?
Oh, fondue. Cheese fondue.
Cheese fondue?
Yeah, that's what I want to eat in the winter. I want to eat cheese fondue with white bread.
Oh my.
Not whole wheat, white bread.
A bit of a glutton, are we? Cool.
Yes.
Love it.
Yep.
Okay, fantastic. So I'll do a quick summary of sort of capturing the talk, and while you keep thinking about what it is that you want to leave the audience with, that gives you some time. Okay, so from soup to nuts, essentially we covered one is what it takes to close a $600 million boring, drab, procurement type treasury deal.
Yep.
And then what are some of the learnings from that, and how to build compassion and commitment into your sales, into your philosophy as a person who you are, and being curious, being that eternal blue belt. And from there, we got into, you know, if you are that person who is today starting off your journey as and wanted to starting to sell yourself, then you want to start off with that philosophy first, the brain, heart, commitment, and the ability to communicate and have some sort of a way to receive payments. And then you want to forget the websites, forget wasting time on marketing materials and writing for having FOMO and writing all this content on LinkedIn. Just look at the people that you know, call them, learn about what their pains are, go back to them with an offer, look for buying signals. Stop talking when you hear those buying signals.
Yep.
And close that deal, do it a couple of times, find what the patterns are and productize that, and then, you know, retire. Just kidding. That part I just made up. But you want to be in that conversation, you want to be doing a lot of being curious, fishing for their pains, looking for, you know, what their fears are, looking for that, what are they not saying, pick those apart, do some of that. And as you kind of go through that process, you want to think about how to make that offer compelling. I think that was really brilliant how you sort of captured that piece, is, you know, putting a time frame on it, you know, giving them the right incentive and packaging up that offer in a way that makes it feel like the right time. So they're looking at the part of, from a client side, the cost of inaction. What if they don't do this? That adds that time factor to it. In addition, from your side of, the sooner you close this, the better the offer might get.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, any pieces and elements that I've missed in the summary, please add to that, and including what you were going to say anyways.
Yeah.
And then finally, I'm not going to summarize everything because I would recommend that you listen to the whole podcast. But the other one thing I just wanted to quickly call out, which I thought was really sort of the underlying crux of this whole soup to nuts piece, was, you know, get rid of that low vibration energy and don't be needy. You know, I think anybody who's starting out, that's the first thing. So whether that's having a little bit of a runway, so you're, each client is not, you're not dependent on each client closing for you to be able to sustain yourself. And what are other things that need to happen so you don't give off that energy and you're truly trying to help and not trying to sell. And I think that sort of captures everything that we've talked about. And I'm going to hand it over to you to close this and land it.
I think the piece that I want to leave everyone with, because I found this really helpful when I approached my sales conversations, or just kind of how I view sales, is I really, especially if you are in the business of selling some form of transformation. So it's a little bit different for people who sell products, but if you sell some form of transformation, if you're a coach or you're a consultant, there's a before and after, they're distinct. Sales really is about transfer of confidence and the transfer of energy and the transfer of belief. And I think that when you use that as a guiding principle to kind of go in to these conversations and to just kind of have that as your mindset. It's really hard to exude needy energy. It's really hard to exude desperation. And it is an attractive state that you are entering the conversation, and it's really compelling and it's really powerful. So I think, you know, that's kind of, that has been a key piece for me, just understanding that when I talk to people, one of the things, one of the values that they get, it's a byproduct of our conversation, but it's increased confidence in their ability to do something and, or their ability to achieve their goal. Like that is, in a nutshell, what sales is. And so I think that that has always been really helpful in making sure that I'm high vibe, high energy, and sort of staving off any of the insecurities or fears around sales. And then the other piece is like, it is a practice. It's a practice, not a process. Like it is the act of showing up every single day, making yourself uncomfortable, doing scary things, and reaching out to people. This is the topic of our next TED Talk, which is how inbound marketing has created an army of order takers. Like no one is a true salesperson anymore. They're only kind of, they're relying on like inbound marketing to generate all of their leads. And they're only speaking with people who already know they want to buy. Like that's a cashier at McDonald's. That's not a salesperson. So I think, you know, the final piece is being really clear on what your revenue generating activities are. What are those? And doing them every single day, practicing those revenue generating activities. Maybe it is cold calling. Maybe it's cold emailing. Maybe it's mining LinkedIn and seeing who your right prospects are and reaching out to them to develop and foster relationships. But I think being very clear about what those revenue generating activities are and then trying to make sure that you do them every day is part of this practice that I'm talking about.
Love it. Amazing. You just put a beautiful ribbon on it. So now, where can people who are interested in what you offer reach out to you? What's the best way to reach out to you? How do you like to be approached on LinkedIn or online or however? What is the best way for you?
Yeah, I think the best place for people to find me is on my LinkedIn, Talitha Davis. And they will get, you know, I'm on there every day, but they'll also get access to a lot of the articles that I write, which talk a lot about the tactical strategies of what it takes to be a good salesperson, but also offering sort of fresh perspectives on sales tools and knowledge that we already know, but might be sort of packaged in a different perspective that would be palatable or appealing to them. So on my LinkedIn is the best way to connect with me.
Amazing. There you have it, folks. That was a wonderful conversation. I learned a lot. I had a lot of fun. And hopefully we can do TED Talk too.
The people deserve it. Paul, you're a great interviewer. Thank you. This was a lot of fun.
Yeah, I had a lot of fun too. Thank you.